From Ohio to Maine, Oklahoma to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the American Legislative Exchange Council has released its 2020 Rich States, Poor States report card on the economic health of the various states. Jonathan Williams of ALEC joins us with details. With Labor Day in the rearview mirror, the presidential campaign hits high gear, and with it, sensational books and articles from the left. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth joins us with the real story. A property rights case from Nebraska involving proper notice before foreclosure may be headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Christina Martin from the Pacific Legal Foundation. And social media is playing an increasingly important role in presidential campaigns, but have these platforms become too biased and too powerful? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explores on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. While the United States competes in the world economy, individual states compete among themselves, and some do better than others when it comes to state policies that promote economic growth and development. Jonathan Williams is Executive Vice President and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. He is co-author of the annual Rich States, Poor States Report with Art Laufer and Stephen Moore. He is here to talk about the latest ranking of the 50 states. Jonathan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jonathan, we've had you on each year as the Rich States, Poor States report has been issued. But for those in our audience who may not be familiar, tell us what the Rich States, Poor States report is all about.
Well, thanks, Loman, for having me back as always, and greetings from the land of make-believe here in Washington, D.C. We put together the Rich States, Poor States report really as a barometer that state policymakers and concerned taxpayers across the country can use in order to measure their state's economic competitiveness versus the other 49, basing out the idea that we have these 50 laboratories of democracy. We know that states are always in competition with each other for jobs and for new population growth and new economic growth. And so Art Laufer and Steve Moore and I put together this now 13 years ago as a way to look at the tax policy and the regulation and the labor policy and the things that we know matter for economic growth, and distill that down into a ranking that's easy to use for things that state lawmakers and state capitals across the country can easily change year over year to make themselves more competitive.
Taking a look then at these rankings, Jonathan, what sort of factors go into developing the overall ranking? What policy areas do you look at?
So we focus it on really economic policy generally, but a focus on tax policy, because we know that the higher the taxes, it's really putting a price on work and savings and investment in that state relative to another state. We look at regulations, oftentimes neglected, but often very, very important, obviously, for business investment decisions. And we look at labor policy. So if you were to look at the things that we know matter for economic growth, we know that state legislators can control these things versus a lot of these other rankings of states that we see out there from things that state lawmakers wish they could control, like weather and quality of life and things like that. These are variables that can make a difference and make a break or state when it comes to economic growth. And they're also things that are within the grasp of policymakers. So these are important variables, things that are debated every single year. And it's really all about states being competitive with each other and how to be best positioned to recover now from this pandemic.
And so let's take a look at these rankings. Which states came in at the top of your rankings this year, the top five or six states? And what are they doing that makes them so successful, Jonathan?
A lot of interesting stories to unpack out of the top five states. Number five, North Carolina, Indiana, Idaho, Wyoming, and then Utah at number one. And these states are very competitive states. They've been reducing tax rates in order to attract business and individual taxpayers. They've been very successful in those measures. Indiana and North Carolina were two states that have really made huge strides over these 13 years. Moving up to the top five from middle of the pack because of real economic policy reforms like right to work in Indiana and really historic tax reform in North Carolina. you know, Idaho and Wyoming are states that have been competitive for a while. Wyoming is one of two states in America that taxes neither personal or corporate income, has a 0% price of work in those areas. And then Utah has been at number one for all 13 editions of our report, Loman. And there's lots of interesting stories to unpack there. But they've tackled pension reform, something that you and I have talked about many times, that states like Illinois and others are resistant to tackle. And now they're asking for a federal bailout of states because they haven't handled their own problems well. Utah has been ahead of that curve. And they've also done something that is elected officials think about reelection this year. They're going to doors. One of the things they always hear about the most are property taxes. And why are my property tax burdens so high? Utah has, I think, really figured out the innovative way to tackle that through their truth in taxation law. And so Utah has, I think, been a really good example for how free market reforms can help make a state prosperous. And Utah has all the results to prove it. This isn't just some economic empty model. The results are there. Utah has been leading the way when it comes to GDP growth. In-migration has been great. And unemployment, the lowest unemployment rate in America, belongs to the number one state in rich states, poor states, Utah.
And, of course, there are always those four or five states that dwell in the cellar, and they haven't changed a whole lot over the years, have they?
Unsurprisingly, no. And these are really important examples because they tell us what not to do when it comes to policymaking. And many of these have been at the bottom, as you mentioned, for many, many years. California, highest income taxes in America at 13.3%. You may have seen some of the recent proposals that would even raise those taxes further or institute a state-level wealth tax, as some left-wing elected officials in California have discussed. Illinois is referenced with their massive debt and unfunded liability problems. New Jersey, Vermont, Bernie Sanders, Vermont. And 50th out of 50 almost every year in this report, New York, with the massive out-migration of well over a million Americans voting with their feet outside of New York. And these, are, you know, unfortunately, are states that have also been lining up asking for a federal bailout because they have not handled their own finances in a responsible way. They're asking for taxpayers in the rest of America to pick up the tab and pay for their mistakes that they've made now for well more than a decade.
In terms of that out-migration that you referenced in New York, was this study conducted before the coronavirus pandemic? Because we've seen the number of people packing up the U-Haul and moving out of New York City in particular really escalate in recent months.
Excellent point. And the answer to that is all of our data comes as of January 1st of 2020. And so none of the coronavirus and pandemic and government shutdown responses have been measured yet in this out-migration data. And so if anything, we know the numbers were stark and the out-migration was massive in places like New York and California and Illinois prior to coronavirus. But I think, as you point out, those numbers will absolutely enhance and just out of the cities as we've seen this new kind of future of work. So many people going remote. So many people may never go back to the office as they once did in places like high-cost New York or San Francisco. I expect these numbers to absolutely enhance the out-migration from these high-tax states moving forward.
In terms now of movement, either up or down, Jonathan, any particular states stand out this time around?
Well, there was a couple of really interesting stories here, and one was Wyoming that moved all the way up to number two. We referenced them a little bit earlier, a state that's always been pretty competitive, but this is their best ranking ever in 13 years in our Rich States, Poor States report.
We have been talking with Jonathan Williams. Jonathan is Executive Vice President and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. We've been talking about the 13th annual Rich States, Poor States report. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about ALEC and also where can folks go to read the report?
Well, ALEC has been around now for nearly 50 years as really the nation's largest voluntary membership organization of state legislators. And we revolve around really three principles, free markets, limited government, and federalism. And our website, ALEC.org, is an amazing resource, not just with this report, but so many others across the economic policy area. I also invite your listeners to go to richstatespoorstates.org.
Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council, co-author of Rich States, Poor States. Jonathan, thank you as always for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me as always, my friend. Keep up the good work.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, and he joins us every week as we talk about significant political developments and trends around the country. Scott, as always, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks.
Well, of course, we're now after Labor Day, Scott, and the presidential race is in high gear. And already we've had a couple examples of salacious and really extraordinary charges that are being made coming from the left-wing media. Can you talk a bit about what's happened the past week with both the Atlantic article and then, of course, the sad tale of Bob Woodward and the muckraking book that he put out earlier this week?
Let's back up to a previous week when Republicans had what I would view as pretty successful convention. There was a lot of attention to President Trump's speech. The optics of Mike Pence in Maryland was also fantastic. And Republicans did see a little bit of a bump in the national polls following convention week, while Joe Biden really didn't get any sort of a bump in his own week. So now you've got September and less than 2 months to go until Election Day. What do you think is going to happen? Well, it's the juicy flavor of the week. It's not juicy fruit gum, but it's really what kind of salacious stories can the left-wing media put forward to really try to capture the attention of voters that are still making up their minds or that might be able to swing their vote one direction or the other. This Atlantic story, I think, was just pretty pathetic on its face. You're talking about Jeffrey Goldberg, whose wife was a max out donor to Hillary Clinton, had previously also donated to Joe Biden. And then he's going to put out high charging story that the president has called members of the military that were killed in action losers. And there was no attribution. This Atlantic story was just total BS. And then Bob Woodward this week released his book. Bob Woodward is a famous reporter, got his fame through the Nixon investigation and resignation. And he's obviously been reporting on presidents for several decades. Woodward this week alleged that President Trump downplayed the depth and seriousness and really how concerned he was about the coronavirus pandemic publicly, while privately telling Woodward on tape that, hey, this thing is really, really bad and deadly. Obviously, Woodward waited 6 months to release this information so that he could make money. And if it was really that important, you would imagine that he would have gone ahead and written a breaking news article for the Washington Post rather than sit on it for a book. He did have 18 interviews with the president spanning from February to July. There's a lot of other information in the book that is going to be perceived by the left wing as just this damaging, out of control and untempered president that is following the whims and curiosity of North Korea and Kim Jong-un and, you know, all kinds of other crazy things. So what we have to just think about over the next 8 weeks before the election is there's going to be stories like this every week. This is what the left-wing media does in order to depress enthusiasm in the Republican base for the president's reelection, and at the same time, distract away from the things that Biden might do that would create his own hiccups. We know that there's a left-wing bias overall in the media. There are obviously some journalists that have really, really high integrity and folks that are also maybe a little bit biased on the right. But I would say to our listeners today, we know from the last 3.5, almost 4 years, that since day one, the Democrats and the media have been colluding together to weaken President Trump, to take away any sort of political capital that he had. So I'm looking forward to what the next 8 weeks is going to look like. And then there's a couple of really key things for us to focus in on when it comes to issues like mail-in voting.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about mail-in voting as we go through the upcoming week, Scott. But before we go today, talk a little bit about the impact that these constant sabotage pieces that the left keeps coming out with and that, as you've mentioned, we can expect to see periodically over the next 7 or 8 weeks. What impact does all that have on the down ballot races, particularly the many races we have that are contested for seats in the U.S. Senate and the Congress?
I think overall the presidential race is tightening, and we're seeing that a little bit in the national polls, and we're definitely seeing it in the key swing states. Voters are totally paying attention at this point to everything that's going on, and the tighter that the presidential race becomes, the better that it will be for House Republicans, who are really in a tough situation right now to win back that House majority and fire Nancy Pelosi from the speakership. On the other end of Capitol Hill, you've got the United States Senate. There are several vulnerable Republican senators that are at risk of losing their seat and losing the Senate majority. So I think that as the scrutiny becomes higher, as the stories become more salacious, the American people will filter through all the negative media and make a decision for themselves. And as the race tightens, I think that it will certainly have a positive effect down ballot for House Republicans and Senate Republican candidates.
And we are going to keep an eye on especially those key U.S. Senate races also as the weeks go by. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson, who, of course, is with the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, a few words about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We're an advocacy organization that focuses on economic opportunity, liberty, and economic freedom. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is @ClubForGrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
The rights of property owners to receive proper notice before foreclosure proceedings may be headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Christina Martin from the Pacific Legal Foundation.
Nobody likes to pay their property taxes, but of course we have to do it. But if you fall behind on your property taxes in some states, you could end up losing a lot more than just what you owe. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Christina Martin. She is a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and she joins us today to talk about a case that PLF is taking all the way, or hoping to take all the way, to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's a case that I think should really concern all Americans, at least anyone who owns property. Christina, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here, as always, Christina. Your client in this case is a landowner from Omaha, Nebraska, who unfortunately fell behind on his taxes. He owed about $1,000. And then suddenly he found that he'd lost everything. He'd lost all of his land. It was just not his anymore.
That's right, yeah. So the owner, Walter Barnett, he couldn't pay his property taxes. He was struggling financially, and he thought he would be able to get caught up and pay those debts. And then he was shocked to discover that he had actually lost full title to the property, and he never received a notice before they did this. In fact, the notice was sent back, and no one ever bothered to follow up with him. He wasn't home to sign for the notice, and they didn't bother to put a stamp on the envelope and send it back to him. So he lost full title to his property over a debt that was worth just a fraction of the property's value.
Yeah, it sounds like typical bureaucratic malfeasance or just confusion. But when you dig a little bit deeper, that's where this story really gets infuriating for me. He owed about $1,000 in taxes, a little more than that when you add in the penalties and interest. And okay, look, he has to pay that. No one disagrees. But his land was worth a lot more than the value of the taxes that he owed. And he ended up losing, as you said, Christina, the full title. That means he lost all of it. He doesn't own that land anymore because of these unpaid taxes. And I know this is something that PLF has challenged elsewhere. So this isn't just a case of a single stupid rule in Omaha, Nebraska. This is something that goes on in a lot of states.
That's exactly right. Yeah, there's about a dozen states that do something like Nebraska, where they take the full value of the property and either the government keeps it or they give it over to a private investor who just pays the tax debt. It's not sold to the highest bidder. The investor just gets basically the whole property. And so the government's really stealing property and either keeping it and selling it for a profit, or they're giving it to an investor for the investor's profit. And we think that's unconstitutional. And that's an issue we've taken up in other states. But here, the issue is even if the property had been sold the right way, before the government takes your valuable property, it ought to at least ensure that you have a fair notice.
Yeah, that seems like the bare minimum to me. Otherwise, like, it's literally just theft if you don't at least tell somebody why you're doing it. We are talking with Christina Martin, senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, talking about a case that PLF is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to take a look at. And Christina, this comes on the heels of a similar case out of Michigan, a case that you took to the Michigan Supreme Court last year. And in that case, it was a homeowner who had lost his property over a tax debt of less than $10. It was just completely insane. We covered it at Reason.com. And you guys won in the state Supreme Court there, so that's some good news, because now counties in Michigan are somewhat limited in what they can do and how they can seize people's land for these unpaid tax debts. And I guess that's what you're hoping to see, or what you didn't see in Nebraska, and that's why you're asking the U.S. Supreme Court to get involved.
That's exactly right. And fortunately, the Michigan Supreme Court agreed. They said that the government, when they take property and sell it to collect the debt, they have an obligation to return the difference. And Nebraska does not have a similar decision yet. And what they do in Nebraska is they give the property over to a private investor who basically fronts the money to the government in exchange for being able to take profitable interest rate, 14%. And then if it's not paid on time, then the investor gets to ask the government for the full title to the property. So the government just extinguishes the property interest. Here it was worth $25,000. He owed less than $1,000 in taxes, you know, with interest and penalties and whatnot. It was about $1,700 total. And you would think that the government would have to ensure that you get a fair notice. But instead, in Nebraska, what the Nebraska Supreme Court signed off on was that a certified letter was sent to Mr. Barnett. It was returned because he wasn't home to receive it. And that was enough. They didn't even have to put a stamp on that same letter and send it back in regular mail, so he'd at least have a chance of seeing it. Instead, there was a publication in a newspaper where Walter didn't even live, and that was considered enough by the Nebraska Supreme Court. So we're asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn that decision. It's not fair. It's also out of line with all the other states and with the U.S. Supreme Court's previous decisions. And on top of that, the standard here is so remarkably low. Can you imagine if Comcast shut off your internet without actually calling you because you owed them money, or if the power company turned off your power without letting you know first? You know, when you fall behind on those kinds of debts, most people get phone calls, emails, text messages. But in Nebraska, apparently, all they have to do is try to send a letter via certified mail, which, again, you have to be home to actually receive.
Yeah, and of course, the consequences when you're dealing with the government are just so much greater than losing, you know, your internet service or your electricity. You can lose massive amounts of money of equity that you have in your home or your land. And we are really glad, Christina, to have people like you out there fighting to try to fix these things. Thank you so much for your work. Unfortunately, we are out of time to keep talking about this today, but thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you can check out more about Christina's case by heading over to pacificlegal.org. Check out my coverage of that lawsuit in Michigan that we talked about as well. That is at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Have social media platforms become so biased they should be treated as political campaign organizations rather than social platforms? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, offers his opinion on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In the past 4 years, we've heard countless stories and tales of Russian campaign interference, Chinese cyber attacks, and alleged malfeasance by the Trump campaign to steal the election of 2016. The Steele dossier became a household term and commanded untold hours of media attention on the scam assault on our elections and campaigns by the FBI and members of the Obama administration. The FISA process has become tainted almost beyond repair. All of these false claims were merely attempts to distract the American people from an even more insidious threat to our liberties, the absolute assault on the very fabric of our constitutional republic, with the manipulation of news, sources, access, and our freedoms by the censorship of our news. Freedom of the press is so critical to our Bill of Rights and our liberties, but what happens when the very sources of that freedom, the press, become co-opted, preventing the very freedom of the press the Constitution guarantees? In an article from the American Bar Association in 2019 called Freedom of the Press, Challenges to This Pillar of Democracy, the author Stephen J. Wormiel stated, and I quote, "An essential concept in the history of freedom of the press and freedom of speech, predating the First Amendment, has been much debated, the freedom to criticize the government. In 1735, long before the creation of the United States, John Peter Zenger, printer of the New York Weekly Journal, a newspaper critical of then-Governor William Cosby, was tried for a seditious libel, the crime of ridiculing the government, or as practiced in England, ridiculing the king. A jury acquitted Zenger after his attorney persuaded them of what was then a novel concept, that Zenger should be allowed to demonstrate that the statements were true as a defense. This outcome raised consciousness in the colonies about the importance of the press that was free to criticize government," end quote. The question, though, is what happens to freedom of the press and our liberties when the press is the government or the deep state? What happens when bureaucracy controls the news outlets, distribution, what can and cannot be assessed? When such media monopolies occur, the very fabric of our Constitution becomes so undermined that the very concept of freedom of the press is undermined. This discussion is more than an academic one. In the age of social media and a culture in which employees and political agendas drive what is accessible to read and be read, perhaps the freedom of the press belongs to the people and not to the organizations which owned them. Twitter and Facebook have both engaged in a campaign of fact-checking and approving what can and cannot be posted on their sites, for example. The Twitter fact-checking poses the risk that free speech of the individual is limited and their ability to regulate free speech on content with which they disagree is problematic to our liberties. Facebook's approach to fact-checking smacks in the face of almost politically and agenda-driven rather than politically and potentially fact-driven. Once again, free speech of the individual becomes secondary to the entity. Beyond claims of fact-checking, the cancel culture prevalent in corporate America and in newsroom has sparked a debate about to whom free speech applies. James Bennett's resignation as New York Times opinion editor over a Tom Cotton editorial should cause all of us concern when employees can, with impunity, direct corporate strategy with no shareholder input, our entire economy becomes jeopardized. Since knowledge is a never-ending quest for truth, it is absurd to think that a corporate or governmental entity can smoothly or honestly fact-check anything. Is it only the news media, or is it the individual, or is it both when it comes to our freedom of speech? Should free speech apply only to the newsroom and social media giants? Then the monopoly on free speech squelches the very freedom for the individual it is purported to protect. The digital age brings new risks, new opportunities, and new threats. In the days of mega steel, mega oil, and mega railroads, antitrust legislation was needed to protect the economy and the consumer and kept competition vibrant. Perhaps the 2016 election and the interference in our liberties by the social media moguls of 2020 reinforced the need to break up these virtual monopolies to enrich competition to protect our liberties and our freedom of speech. It is time to either break up the social media giants, treat them as news distributors only, and regulate them as monopolies, or force them to register as a coordinated campaign committee and register with the Federal Election Commission. All three are viable options. Until then, the greater threat to the 2020 election is not a foreign entity. It is a social media agenda-driven algorithm desired to influence your reading, your thoughts, and your vote. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBUV-FM in Biloxi, Mississippi, KUKI-FM in Ukiah, California, along with WRFH-FM in Hillsdale, Michigan. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.